Welcome into another edition of the NBC Sports Pro Basketball Talk podcast. Brett Polakoff here with Kurt Heelan. What is going on, Kurt?
Doing well.
Bright and early from Oakland. We'll get you revved up here in a second. And then with us again is Dominic Ridgard of NBC Sports. What is going on, Dom?
Not much, Brett. How you doing, man?
Good. A little excited after that fantastic game two of the NBA Finals. We're going to go ahead and get into it, break it all down. Kurt was in the building last night watching our second straight finals overtime game, first time ever that the first two games of the finals have gone to overtime. This time, a little bit different result. Cleveland came away with the victory, 95-93. LeBron James with another monster performance, albeit, you know, low field goal percentage, but that was kind of the story for both teams all night. Kurt, you were in the building. Why don't you give us an overview of all the craziness that you saw last night?
Yeah, it certainly was crazy. Because, I mean, first off, it's been fun. It hasn't been pretty always, but it's certainly been really fun. I mean, this is the first time ever the first two games went to overtime in the finals. And yeah, at the end of the day, I think the 1-1 split is fair because if you talk to both teams, they both thought we should be up 2-0. I mean, honestly. They both said, and rightfully so, both of them look at opportunities in both of these games and think, coulda, shoulda, woulda, you know? But I think the interesting thing for me going forward and out of this game was, I mean, look, LeBron has been unbelievable, absolutely unbelievable, absolutely. Alvin Gentry used the phrase with me the other day, he's absolutely on a mission. Like, he wants to bring a title there, he wants to secure some legacy there. He is really playing phenomenal ball. But to me, the most interesting thing is that when Irving and Love are out, they defend well. I thought it might have just been a factor of, well, it was a banged-up Bulls team, a banged-up Hawks team, and, you know, whatever the heck the Celtics are at this point. But they really disrupted the flow of Golden State, and the Warriors' offense was not the same.
Well, you know, I was going through the quotes, and Tristan Thompson talked about it afterwards, that the intensity that Matthew Dellavedova brings, you know, just picking up guys full court, you know, getting in their jerseys, the intensity that he brings is contagious, you know, and Thompson said afterwards, he said, look, you know, when he's doing that, the rest of the guys got to step their game up. We can't BS around, is the way he put it. So there's definitely a different dynamic with Dellavedova, you know, doing what he does on the defensive end of the floor. And honestly, the style of basketball that the Cavaliers are playing right now, you know, they're going late into the shot clock and they're defending like crazy. So, you know, the Warriors aren't getting as many transition opportunities as they're used to.
Yep.
And you look at the way that the Cavaliers' defense is playing at a consistent level. What we're seeing from the Warriors, at least what I saw last night, was a bunch of rushed shots. I mean, their shot selection was not great. And I think, you know, obviously when you have shooters as capable as Steph Curry and Klay Thompson, some of that's to be expected, and some of that is what got them here, right? I mean, them dribbling the ball up and jacking long threes early in the shot clock, partially that's their style. But that's not working, you know, against this Cavaliers team. And, you know, Cleveland has been able to, the word that keeps coming up is rhythm. Cleveland has been able to take Golden State out of their rhythm for much of the first two games of this series. Dom, what are you seeing out of this Cavaliers team, and what do you think has been the key to their success?
Yeah, you know, we talked about the defense, and I think one of the main things that they're doing well, and it's working well, is especially because they're slowing it down and you can't get in a good transition flow, whenever they try to find Steph Curry with the ball, they're making a diligent effort to make it a tough catch and a tough transition into the half court. I noticed a couple times on inbound plays, they would literally send two guys at Steph and say, you know what, he's not bringing the ball up. Someone else has to do it. I think they forced it to Draymond a couple times. And it was one of those situations where, you know, if you force Draymond about like 8-10 times a game to be the primary facilitator, he can do well. He'll make a play. He'll find an open player, maybe, you know, get 5-6 good possessions out of it. If you force him to do that 15-18 times, that's when – I think it starts to hurt the Warriors in that it almost puts too much on his plate as a primary facilitator. He can do it in spurts. He can do it when you're not expecting it. But when you're forcing his hand and you're loading up and that's your kind of defensive strategy, I thought it worked really well, and it clearly frustrated the Warriors.
Does this remind you – because the line I used in the story and the thing that I was thinking last night is it reminds me of Memphis. It reminds me of the way they were able for much of that, or for at least the first part of that series, to really disrupt everything Golden State wanted to do. And the same thing happened. The Warriors started rushing their shots a little. They were thinking about the defense. They were shooting earlier in the clock and rushing the shots just a little. And, you know, remember, Curry was like 15 for 40 over a couple games against them. It feels like that to me.
Well, and, you know, how much of the shooting of Golden State last night, you know, Steph Curry obviously had the off game, you know, just 5 of 23 from the field, 2 of 15 from three-point distance. You know, Klay Thompson shot 50% from the field, but only 4 of 12 from three-point distance. You know, to me, you know, some of those shots, a good portion of those shots were open. I think, Curry, you had that in your story. What?
Yeah.
How many of the shots were open versus contested?
The Warriors contested a little. It was 42 of the. I think it was 90 was the final total shots. Shots were contested. So they contested whatever the number was. It was a little bit more than half. However, the Warriors only shot 31% on their uncontested looks, and Curry was 1 of 9. I don't think that's sustainable. But B, it speaks to what you were saying, both of you were saying, that they're rushing it. They're shooting early in the clock. They're not setting their feet and just kind of knocking down their shots. They're not really doing the things they did over the course of the season. When they're in rhythm, it doesn't really matter whether you contest it. Like last year, against Houston in those first three games, I mean, Houston actually defended him fairly well at moments. It didn't matter. Curry was knocking down everything, but he is out of sorts against this defense. And Don made a really good point. I mean, if you watched game one, and they did it less in game two, a little bit. They inbound the ball off a make. They would jump in front of Curry. Like, Curry's not bringing it up. And the Warriors countered. They started putting him in motion, moving him across the court, doing some things to try to free him up to get him the ball to bring it up, especially off misses so they could get out and run a little bit. But they've had to really work at it. This isn't a new strategy. This is what guys did to Magic Johnson back in the day. Like, find him, don't let him get the outlet pass, because if he's got the ball when they're running. But now Golden State's got to adjust. Other guys are going to have to make plays.
So, Dom, what do you see out of this Warriors team as far as the shooting goes, and what do they need to do to sort of regain their rhythm, you know, possibly the way they were able to do, you know, against the Grizzlies early in the playoffs?
Yeah, it's tough, because I think that the shots are still going to the right people. You know, nothing seems out of sorts. I have a question for you guys. I saw the stat fly around before Steph Curry took his fall against the Rockets. He was shooting 47% from the field and 45% from three. After that fall, he's shooting 34% from the field and 26% from three. And I think the sample size is still only, what, like 3 or 4 games? But, you know, it wouldn't shock me if it might not be a full-on injury, but the soreness hasn't gone away, and whatever kind of head injury he did or didn't suffer, it may still have some lingering effect. I saw some – I think it was Marcus Thompson from out in the Bay Area might have tweeted, like, he thinks – or he retweeted someone saying Steph could be dealing with some kind of injury, and, you know, these players never say anything, and they just hide it. I don't know if that's just pure speculation, but it wouldn't shock me if he's still dealing from general soreness. I haven't seen the guy shoot that badly all season.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about for sure. I mean, Curry was 10 of 20 from the field in game one, but, you know, the way he – that fall – the way he landed, you know, it's not just his head, you know, it's his back, his neck. It could be a shoulder thing. And if you have any type of neck or shoulder thing, that will definitely mess up your shot. But, you know, I think right now it's interesting. It's good to look at, but it's, you know, speculation. Like you said, guys aren't going to say anything. They're not going to say I'm hurt. You know, nothing like that's going to happen. I don't know. Kurt, what do you think? Are you seeing something different with Steph Curry's shot?
Not that I've noticed, but it is possible. He does, the form doesn't look different to me. It's not like, it doesn't look like he's compensating noticeably much. That said, and he's still doing his whole warm-up routine out there yesterday and kind of watched him go through his dribbling and shooting and all that. And I don't see anything, but, you know, that doesn't mean that he's not feeling some of the side effects, some of the ill effects from that. So it's distinctly possible. And, you know, I still expect them to figure it out and start going, but Cleveland's got a personality without those guys. I mean, that is a grit and grind team now, and it works for them. I mean, they've got some guys out there, you know, like you said, Dellavedova, who brings some of that. They get enough offense that with that, I mean, you know, like I was comparing it to Memphis, but Memphis didn't have a LeBron. I mean, they've got Marc Gasol, and they've got guys who can score, but they don't have the shooting that you have to respect in the same way, you know, from the outside, and they're a little more defendable. Obviously LeBron isn't terribly defendable. I mean, I think Golden State has done about as good a job as you can do on him when he's in these kind of mission modes. They've made him inefficient, but they can't put up the points. The point about really taking away their transition, about slowing the game down, about going deep into the clock, about not only going deep into the clock, but then, you know, you've got to worry about them on the offensive glass with Tristan Thompson and Timothy Mozgov and apparently Dellavedova now. but you've got, they're not able to just get out. And the thing that's gone from Golden State's offense largely is the easy bucket. They got some in game one. You know, they got some dunks on those back cuts. In this game, though, outside of, I can think of the Clay alley-oop to, you know, Iguodala, you know, some of those easy transition buckets, those are gone. They're having to work for every bucket right now.
Thanks to Mo Spates not being able to jump 2 feet off the ground.
Won
the internet with that play.
Yeah, that was I know you got to reward the big man, but Iggy just finished that, man. Just finish it.
Yeah, Iguodala needs to take that shot for sure. You know, one more thing on the Warriors and their shooting. So, you know, Klay and Curry combined last night 6 of 27 from 3-point distance. So this is what I've maintained about this Warriors team all along, and especially I've been saying it, you know, throughout the playoffs. They're going to shoot these threes anyway. So you need to make it as difficult for them as possible because they're still going to make sure to jack them up, at a high rate. And I think the Cavaliers have done a fantastic job of just not allowing any space around those shots. What we saw at the end of regulation, though, Curry, you know, getting inside the three-point line and getting all the way to the rim for that, you know, scoop shot, I think that's the adjustment for Golden State moving forward. If Cleveland is going to harass them on the perimeter, now look, the Warriors got here by shooting a high volume of threes. But, you know, through the first couple games, those have been tough shots for them. Cleveland's dialed in. They're making it really difficult. They're defending those screen and roll plays on the perimeter extremely well. I would like to see Curry go like the entire first quarter of game three without a three-point attempt, and just every time he gets the ball, look to penetrate and create, you know, either score himself or create for his teammates. And I think that if they made that type of adjustment, that would really sort of shake things up, and it could flip things back in their favor. Dom, what's your take on that theory?
Yeah, I agree. I think that, you know, and I know I talked with Kurt a little bit about this. I was a little hesitant at first with how big the 3-point shot is getting and like kind of this revolution around it. I was a little hesitant at first, but I'm totally buying in. But I also think that they can't be shots that you're purposefully seeking out. They have to come within the framework of the offense, and you have to make sure that they're good shots. You don't just jack them up to jack them up. And I think what you're saying is very valid in that the Cavaliers are seeking to form a perimeter around the 3-point line and say, these aren't the shots you guys are going to get. These aren't the looks you guys are going to get open. You know what I mean? These are going to be the most contested shots out of all the shots you take are going to be these 3-pointers. And like you said, it's visibly an adjustment that could be made very easily between now and game three. And I actually agree with you. I think that it would really work if Steph Curry looked to dribble penetrate and either go to the rim or look to maybe do a pocket pass or an alley-oop to whoever screens him on a screen and roll. And you still spread the floor out. You could still have Clay in one corner and Barnes in another corner. And if the defense sucks in, you can still kick it out, and then those threes will be more open. But you have to put pressure going to the basket and then kind of play inside out that way. You know, three-pointers, I think, are the most valuable when they come off drive and kick. So it's not – it's still kind of inside-out basketball, but it's just different. It's more guard-centric as opposed to being in the post-centric.
You guys are channeling Phil Jackson. He loves you guys right now. But but the point is valid, and frankly, Phil's point was valid, which is that if you go hunting those shots, and that was always my issue with what he said. He's like, you know, his point was if you go hunting those shots, you're doing it wrong. Golden State doesn't hunt them. I mean, they're generally pretty good looks, but they struggled in the series, and like you said, I don't think they've adjusted well enough to just attacking and getting inside. And look, it's time to be, you know, to use a model a little more Houston-like, and that Houston jacks up, you know, jacks up threes at the same rate Golden State does, but their other shots come at the rim. Now, granted, they have Dwight Howard, but it's you know, James Harden like a bowling ball down the lane, you know, getting to the rim and finishing or getting fouled, drawing that in, and then kicking out. And I think that's, you know, they certainly have the shooters to do that. They have not only, by the way, not only can Curry get in the lane. I mean, Thompson can put the ball down and get in the lane. You've got to do that. You've got to put some pressure on that defense, put a little pressure on Mozgov, maybe get some guys in foul trouble and see what happens. I think that you're going to, I think it's a smart strategy, and I think you may very well see more of that in the next game.
All right, well, let's talk about the Cavaliers a little bit. Obviously, you know, the style that they're playing is a good match for them so far in these playoffs, especially, you know, with Kyrie out, you know, with Tristan Thompson, you know, now in the starting lineup, you know, the way he just, you know, focuses on the rebounding, he's just very tough, you know, for Golden State to deal with. But let's talk about LeBron James. I mean, incredible performance, obviously, all-around performance, you know, did everything for those guys, 50 minutes, but only shot 11 of 35 from the field, and I think he didn't make a field goal after hitting that long three in the fourth quarter to put him up, you know, double digits before the Warriors made that run and came back. How incredible is it that the Cavaliers could still pull this out with LeBron only shooting 11 of 35 from the field despite, you know, his high point total because he was able to get to the free throw line?
You know, just looking at the box score, and, you know, this would require some research, but this has to be at least one of the top three or four game, or one of the three or four lowest field goal percentages from a winning team. They shot 32% from the field and won, which is which is amazing. I know they didn't shoot well, but 32.2%, 29 of 90 is crazy to think that they could shoot like that and win. But to your point, you know, LeBron only shot 11 of 35, but he did get 18 free throw attempts, which is huge because especially for him playing all those minutes, kind of being able to get easy points from the line and kind of, again, slow the game down, muck it up. They shot 40 free throw attempts, 15 more than the Warriors. I think that was also part of their game plan is that, you know, with LeBron attacking so much and them crashing the board so hard, that they would eventually start to wear down the Warriors' defense and they would start playing more with their hands and not so much with their feet, kind of swiping at the ball and kind of half-hearted attempts at blocks. Even Mozgov had 12 free throw attempts. So I think even though LeBron didn't shoot well, I think the fact that he went to the line 18 times definitely kind of buoys the fact that he shot so poorly from the field.
Definitely. I feel like he's doing that. He's setting, I mean, he was setting guys up and they were knocking it down. They got much better bench play in this game. We'll discuss J.R. Smith in a minute. But they did get, you know, 21 points off the bench, which was way more than game one. They've got to have, obviously, other guys step up. LeBron has been putting up and carrying. You know, the efficiency doesn't bother me as much, like you said, because he's, A, getting to the line, and, B, the ridiculous load he's got to carry right now. Offensively, it's just the efficiency is going to suffer a little bit. But he's getting it done. And more than, like I said, more than just putting up numbers and finding some guys that were open, he has completely controlled the tempo in the first two games. It has taken Golden State out of their rhythm, like we said. He is the guy dominating the ball, dominating the clock, and able to able to get the game played at the Cavaliers' pace and flow, and that has been huge. He's been a floor general as much as he's been just a great, you know, great player in the post, and his versatility is handy here. I mean, he puts the ball in the post, you can get him the ball in the wing, you can do it, you know, it really doesn't matter where he gets the ball, he can make something happen from there. I think he gets a little tired at the end. He admitted to being tired at the end of the game last night, and it was going to be interesting because now they go every other day, and if he's got to carry that kind of time minutes and that kind of load, you know, it's every other day now, which is, he gets a day off, but it's only one, and it's not two like before the last one. It'll be interesting to see if he starts to wear it all, because at the end of games, he's taken those step backs. He stepped on the last play. You know, he tried to drive a couple times, got blocked by Draymond at the end, wasn't able to finish another one. But when he gets a little tired, that's when he goes to the step backs. That's when he kind of settles a little bit. And he seemed to do more of that late in this game because he ended up with, was it 50? I mean, it was, it's a crazy amount of minutes.
Well, you mentioned J.R. Smith. And he had a few rough plays there, you know, towards the end. Three bad fouls, or what was characterized as bad fouls. You know, Kurt, I'll get your take on this. The one where he hacked, I think it was, who was it flying to the rim? Was it Harrison Barnes?
Yeah, it was Barnes.
Yeah.
The three-point play?
To me, that one wasn't a bad foul because you don't want to give up, you know, easy points. You don't want to give up layups. He was just late. You know, he was just a split second late. So to me, I mean, he was getting killed on the broadcast for that. And to me, I was like, well, that's not really that bad of a foul. You know, however, four-point plays, you know, behind the three-point line, those are a little rough.
Yeah. And the other one was the stupid foul of Curry in the backcourt reaching.
Yeah, the reach. Yeah.
That was, you know, it's just once a Nick, always a Nick, man. He reverted to his New York form on that one. That was a bad game from him. The thing is, if there's one guy who's just going to ignore that now and come out on Tuesday night and suddenly hit every contested shot and make every play, it's him. He is fully capable. There's still going to be a J.R. Smith game in this series. There's still going to be one game where he just lights it up. And they don't have the depth or the options not to use him and figure out if it's one of those nights.
I was just going to say that they don't have a choice. You know, there's no depth on that team. You know, you're not going to put in Joe Harris, that's for sure.
James Jones gave them a nice bump last night, though. Gotta say.
But Jarris, he still played 38 minutes, which is a ton. I mean, I know there's the overtime. I think he played the whole overtime. But, you know, that's they lean on the guy. You know, they need him. And like you were saying, Brett, like the Harrison Barnes one was a tough play. He was just late. And if he winds up and tries to foul Barnes even harder, you risk a flagrant foul, which would have gotten
him
crushed even more. I think it speaks to more of how much reputation kind of precedes you in the NBA in a good way and a bad way. You know, like Matthew Dellavedova is getting a ton of credit, deservedly so, for how he played defense on Steph Curry. But you know, he's one of those guys I call like reputation defenders, where he's really, really good, but anybody else, he would have fouled out of the game in like 8 minutes. Like there are plays where he's literally grabbing Steph Curry's jersey as he's trying to run away, and they don't call anything. And then Andre Iguodala is getting crushed in the post, and he tries to reach in, doesn't even touch LeBron, and they blow it. You know what I mean? So it's one of those things.
You know, I'll say this. My sense in the arena was that, and this isn't all that common at this level of the NBA, that different officials were calling it at different levels. Like, there's nights, you know, it's all you know, there's nights that, you know, the refs will let it go a little bit. There's nights games are called tighter. But it was like different officials were calling it at different levels in this game, and the guys on both teams really struggled to adjust to that.
Well, that Iguodala rake across LeBron's arms was probably the most egregious non-call, except you could argue that LeBron traveled before that. So,
absolutely. Yeah. They were getting killed on the internet about that play. You know, just it was so. Tony Brothers was standing right in front of him. There's no way you couldn't hear hand smack skin on that play if you didn't see it at least. You know, it was bad.
By the way, we'll see what Cleveland's like. You've got to get all the reputation about this building being loud is legitimate. And this building is, it is deafening, and I really think it does get loud enough at peak moments in that arena where referees do rely on their hearing. Like, they do rely on hearing that sound. And I think they're not hearing some stuff that they normally hear, especially at peak times. Cause I think that building does get that loud, and it does seem to. I don't think the fans get in the heads of the officials, but if they're not hearing stuff they normally hear, it does affect their calls.
Well, and on that play, you wonder what the official was looking at, because it happened right in front of them. I mean,
yeah,
it was clearly a hack on the arm. It's about as big of a hack on the arm as you'll ever see, you know, on a jump shot on a play like that. So you have to wonder, what was he looking at? If he wasn't looking at his arm, was he looking at the footwork, and then he chose not to call the travel? I mean, we're breaking down this one play to a ridiculous level and putting a lot of heat on the official. I always say, if we know the referee's name, which, you know, we already mentioned it, that's not good. We should never know the referee's names, based on reputation. So, I think we're making a lot about that one play, but it was pretty egregious. Wanted to get your guys'
On the flip side of this, I will just say, from my mentions and probably yours, guys, too, but my mentions on Twitter, both fan bases feel screwed by the referees. So, if nothing else, they were unevenly unfair.
Yeah, I mean, that's always, I never even usually, take officiating into account, because I figure it's easy.
And I've said this on, my old blog, and I've said this on this blog a million times. I always go back to one of my coaches, which was when we were complaining about at end of a game, lost a close game, bad call at the end of the game. And we were complaining in the locker room, and the coach walked in, bounced a clipboard off the wall. Shattered a clipboard off the wall would be a better phrase for that. Looked at us and said, if you hadn't bleeping blown the 15-point lead you had in the second quarter with your lazy play, it wouldn't have mattered. So there's always, for all the plays you think the ref did, there were always plays that the team didn't make that you could have changed it to. So,
well, right. It's the other thing you always hear from coaches is, don't put yourselves in a position where one call is gonna make or break you. Don't put yourselves in, win the game, comfortably, and you won't have to worry about it. So we talked about this at the end of the game one. So I wanted to get your guys to take this time around. We had two possessions, one at the end of regulation from LeBron and the Cavs, and one at the end of overtime with Curry and the Warriors, where they have shots to win the game. Neither one of them were able to do it on those individual plays. So let's look at LeBron at the end of regulation. Got the ball out at the top of the circle this time with about 7 seconds left. So he was the initial guy with the ball. And like last time, it was Kyrie dribbling it down and tossing it to LeBron with just a few seconds left. I like the way he attacked the basket. Put the onus on the officials to make a call. To get a shot at the rim and see what happens. Dom, what do you think? What did you see on that final play? Is that pretty much what you expected from LeBron this time around?
That's what I was hoping for. I think he definitely heard, or, he says those guys all say they don't listen to the media or what people say. I don't know where it came from, but I definitely think he heard the criticism of the last shot that he took, or maybe it came from himself. He watched a film and realized that he kind of let the Warriors off easy when he took the jump shot in game one. So I think his mindset was, I'm going to get to the basket, and if the refs don't make the call, I'm going to try and finish at the rim. And he came really close. Like, that was I think that's a high percentage shot for him. I've seen him make that layup tons of times. I really liked his the decision making. He went hard. There was a good chance he did get some contact. Maybe the refs just swallowed the whistle. Who knows? But I thought that was definitely the right decision, 100%.
Yeah, by the way, interesting comment from LeBron after the game. He made this, he's talking about, and I was in the room, he's talking about, hey, we've got, my motivation to, bring a championship back to Cleveland, whatever. And at one point he goes, I've got some other motivation I can't talk about right now. I'm like, what? He's certainly, like I said, he's certainly on a mission. He's certainly fired up. I don't know if that's the, hey, Steph got the MVP and I should have gotten the MVP, or what his magical motivation is, but
I think that could be the Draymond thing too.
Yeah, maybe.
I think so.
But
he would never admit it, but I think so.
But yeah, exactly. Or he might admit it after this is over. But he that was the way you want him to handle that play. I mean, he did put his head down and get to the rim, and like you said, he finished that. He put the pressure on the officials to make the call. It didn't happen this time. But if you're a Cavs fan, or frankly, David Blatt or a Cavs coach, you'll take that. I mean, honestly, he makes that play more than he misses it. It just didn't work there.
Well, let's talk about Steph Curry's shot near the end of the overtime session with about 7 seconds left. Cleveland was up 94-93. What I didn't like about this play, I mean, Curry taking the shot is fine. What I didn't like about the way this play was drawn up is that you see Klay Thompson, you know, come from the weak side, run along the baseline and set up shop in the corner, where Iman Shumpert is obviously going to be there. He's not going to leave Klay Thompson in the corner. So he's right there on him. And then Curry goes and gets the ball on the same side of the floor. And when Curry goes to dribble and try to shake his defender or maybe create some space, he basically dribbles right into Iman Shumpert because of where Thompson is placed on the floor. So I thought, you never know exactly how it was drawn up or if Curry was supposed to go get the ball there where he got it on the inbounds. Maybe it was supposed to go out top to Iguodala first. You know, they had plenty of time, so who knows. But the way that play developed just made that shot insanely difficult for Curry.
Their spacing was weird all night, though. I mean, they really, and again, credit to the Cavaliers' defense for some of that, but some of that was just, they oddly clumped in a way that we haven't seen from them much this season. It was interesting, and that was a perfect example of it. That wasn't a flowing play in the least.
Yeah, the thing with me for that shot, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, I agree, I didn't think the spacing was that great. I thought it was a tough shot, but didn't he airball it? Like, it was a really ugly miss, which, you know, a miss is a miss. You could debate that. But it looked like he was uncomfortable taking the shot. And, you know, you want to be careful with the words you use when guys miss these kind of game-ending situations. But that it looked a little like he kind of forced that shot and was pressing a little bit. It didn't look like, you know, a natural shot from him. And you rarely see a guy that's good of a shooter airball. So, you know, maybe it was nerves. Maybe he realized he was struggling and it was in his head. But I didn't think it was a great shot, but the fact that he missed it so badly really stood out to me.
I just think it was really a function of the defense. I think he was off balance a little bit. You know, obviously Dellavedova contested, but I think maybe he didn't expect, you know, maybe he didn't realize where he was on the court. Maybe he didn't expect Shumpert to be able to, you know, come with that late help and be that close to him. I think, to me, that's what bothered him, you know, more than anything else. But again, it was just an off night for him overall. And that shot was just way more difficult than necessary thanks to the way the Warriors had it spaced out.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see going forward because for all we've said about this, how many times have we watched Curry just take off-balance ridiculous shots here and knock them down? He just this was not his night to do that.
Sure. If you don't mind, go back to Cleveland, and I'm looking at the play-by-play. It's funny because we have like two kind of competing narratives with LeBron about, you know, he's more, you know, the whole kind of cliche. He's not Michael. He's more Magic. He looks to play make. And when they were up 87-85, I believe, and we saw it kind of both sides of LeBron in the two kind of final possessions for the Cavs, where that he drove to the lane, he collapsed the defense, and they were up 87-85 with 16 seconds left, and he kicked it out to Iman Shumpert for three, and he was wide open, I believe, in the right corner, and the guy just completely airballs it, like doesn't hit the rim. It goes to Draymond, and that kind of leads to kind of the semi transition that got Steph right to the basket for the tying bucket. And then he goes to the lane on the next possession and misses that layup. So we saw him kind of he tried the let me kick it to a teammate and make the right basketball play, quote unquote, and see what happened and take the results with what happens, and Shumpert airballed it. And then so the next possession down, you know, we talked about it. I think he had in his mind, like, I'm taking the shot, I'm getting to the rim, and we're going to live with the results I get. And, you know, there was three defenders in the air on him. If you look back at the tape, it's very possible that someone might have been open on the pass, even though there was only 2 seconds left. But he decided to, you know, I'm going to try and win it for us, and he missed. It would be interesting to see, you know, we always talk about it, the hindsight's 20/20, but the conversations that would be happening if the Warriors won in overtime, because he missed that shot, and I think, like you said, Brett, I think he went scoreless in the overtime. It's funny how these things can change so quickly, how these conversations, especially about LeBron, can change so quickly.
I think we should be having the same sort, this about the Warriors as well, in this sense. We love their flair. We love their style. We've been saying, oh, they're not in their rhythm. We're not seeing that flow. You know what comes with that when you pressure them, though? They make some really odd decisions at points, especially under pressure. And lead to, I mean, they've had turnovers all season, and they've just kind of accepted that as part of how they're playing. But they have some really bad decision-making at points and some really odd decisions down the stretch, including, look, remember, they have about 4 seconds left after that last free throw to try and get it and made a poor decision on the lob, you know, the pass up ahead. They got a few of those down the stretch. It's part of, I don't know that that's going to change because it's kind of who they are, but they're going to have to find a way to make those plays rather than having some ugly, sloppy turnovers late in games.
All right, well, let's look ahead to game two. What do we expect out of this Warriors team in terms of adjustments? I already kind of said what I'd like to see from Steph Curry. Kurt, what do you think the Warriors need to do to get back on track and reclaim home court advantage?
Well, I think game three is going to be fascinating because the Warriors, when you talk to them and their coaches and on and off the record, particularly off, frankly, and I was unfortunate to get to do some of that before game two, when you ask about adjustments, they're like, we're not really making any because we didn't play well in game one, and they really thought that they would come out and just find their groove in game two. They thought they'd get back to what they want to do, and they said all the right things about, you know, we know how good they are without Kyrie and LeBron. You know, they knew the numbers about without Kyrie and Love, how good the defense had been. And they were very cautious and warned the Warriors players, like, hey, you know, you've got to take advantage of this. 4 years ago, we all said, you know what, after this performance, we can expect, you know, Oklahoma City to be in the finals like 3 out of the next 5 years, and they're going to be phenomenal. And we're, you know, they haven't, it's never been the same. You can't, you know, the Dan Marino thing. Don't assume you're coming back, man. You know, you take advantage of the opportunity you've got. And all that said, they didn't really change anything. They thought they could just do what they do better. Now they're going to make changes. They're really patient about making major adjustments, but I think you're going to see them. I think, A, you're going to see them go to the rim, but there'll be some other surprises, as there was in, you know, remember they were down 2-1 to Memphis, and then suddenly made some defensive switches, made some changes, and they just owned that series. I don't know that it's going to be that dramatic, but I think you're going to see some things we don't expect from them because they didn't really do anything in this game.
Dom, what are you looking for out of the Warriors as the series shifts to Cleveland?
I think that they're going to – well, first of all, I think that Draymond is going to look to – I think they're going to keep forcing him to play make. I think he's going to look to trying to get to the rim a little more. I know he took 6 free throws in game two, but he was only 2 of 7 from the field. I think he's kind of stood out to me as the guy who might be playing a little bit, I guess, below his kind of level of play. So I look for him to kind of be more aggressive. I look for, honestly, to have more active hands on defense because – if I know LeBron's doing a lot of ISO, but I feel like they're doing almost I think you can fall into ball watching on defense as much as you can fall into it on offense and not kind of looking for where you can take advantage of opportunities. You know, I think Steve Kerr said it, you know, we attack on offense, we attack on defense, you know, and I know it's the Cavaliers kind of style of play kind of limits how much you can fully attack on defense. But I think the same way you're seeing, you know, Matthew Dellavedova do full court pressure and guys are getting into guys' shirts, I think Steve Kerr is going to say, hey, there's no reason we can't do this too. We've got more guys. We've got more bench depth. If you need a couple more minutes here or there to rest, like, we're more capable of doing that than they are. So I think defensively you're going to see them definitely pick up the intensity. And I could see pressuring Matthew Dellavedova full court if he's bringing up the ball. You know, he's known better on the defensive end for his ball handling and kind of playmaking facilitating. So I think we're going to see the Warriors say, okay, we see your defensive intensity and we'll raise you. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And by the way, the other thing you can do along those lines is again, to counter, you know, the Cavaliers have made it difficult to get the ball in Curry's hands. Make it as difficult as possible to get it in LeBron's hands. They've done better at that in the half court. Iguodala did a nice job of that at points, but I think you could be more consistent about it.
when you mentioned Dellavedova and the ball handling, I felt like that was a turnover waiting to happen, basically, every time he had the ball in the half court. You know, he was just, he did turn it over a few times, you know, trying to get into the paint. So that's a matchup, I think, when the ball ends up in his hands, that the Warriors could potentially look to exploit. And look, if they can force the issue a little bit more on the defensive end of the floor, I mean, obviously, this is a team with the league's best defense all season long. You know, that was probably more tactical than it was, you know, individual defenders once you get past Draymond Green and Iguodala. But I just think if they can force the issue, like you mentioned, Dom, then that could create some additional turnover opportunities, and it'll allow them to get out in transition and get some opportunities on the secondary break as well. And then that may very well do a lot to help get their offense back on track.
Look, their offense definitely feeds off their defense. If they can get, you know, if they're more aggressive and create some live ball turnovers, that leads to the transition buckets and the easy buckets that make, I mean, this is in the same sense that this happened with LeBron, frankly, LeBron's teams in Miami. So they played that high-pressure defense. They're looking to force turnovers because nobody was going to stop that team in transition. And when they went on those little 10-0 runs or something in the middle of a game, and they play you pretty even the rest of the way, but you could never make up for those spurts. And the Warriors kind of are the same way, but they haven't been able to get those spurts outside of, you know, with 13-2 run at the end of the game and those kind of things. But they haven't sustained, you know, they haven't had a couple of them a game, and that might start to change.
All right, before we get out of here, I want to get your guys' take on the series now. And we've seen two full games. You know, like you said, either team could have been up 2-0 by now. We're tied at one game apiece, heading back to Cleveland. Series prediction at this point. Dom, we'll start with you.
You know, I picked the Warriors in six when we our preview podcast, and I'm sticking to it. I think that the Warriors are going to come out, pick up their defensive intensity in game three, and I expect them to win game three. You know, this is now, I believe, it's every other day between games three and four, I believe. You know, I'm picking the Warriors to win game three, but I think you can absolutely slam dunk at home that they'll at least get a split in Cleveland. So my thought on the series hasn't changed from, I guess, what I picked originally in that regard. But I will say that, you know, you thought about this series in two parts. You thought about this series before game one, and then you kind of had to reevaluate after the Kyrie Irving injury. And after the Kyrie Irving injury, I thought, you know, Cleveland will be lucky to get a game. I really did. And I was extremely impressed by LeBron and the team as a whole. I think, and the coaching staff, I think they came out with a great game plan. I think they executed well. I think LeBron is pouring everything he has into every one of these games, and it's so palpable. You know, if you were one of those LeBron James detractors, or you were on the fence or whatever have you, I don't know what else will persuade you onto this guy's side. If you're not watching these finals, or if you are and you don't, I don't know what else can change your mind. So from that standpoint, I definitely think it's going to be competitive. I didn't think that after the Kyrie Irving injury, but at the end of the day, I think the Warriors' depth will play out. I think these guys from Cleveland have to get tired at some point, especially LeBron. So I'm still picking Warriors in six.
Yeah, I'm not going to change off. I went into this series thinking more Warriors. I said Warriors. I mean, Warriors in six. I was almost said five. I went with six. I think this changes it to more six or seven. I mean, it is possible they push it that far now, but I'm not coming off Golden State yet, because, like I said, I still think that they can play a lot better, that they can have adjustments, and the simple thing is, they've got the pieces to move around the chessboard. Steve Kerr can make adjustments in a way David Blatt simply can't right now, or can't counter what happens as well. They've got one style. They've got to grit and grind this thing out. And that's going to make it an entertaining style matchup. But at the end of the day, I think the Warriors figure it out.
Yeah, I went with the Cavaliers before the series started, but I was counting on or projecting a healthy Kyrie Irving for the series. So, you know, once he went out, you know, that obviously changes things somewhat significantly, but I will stick with Cleveland, thinking that LeBron James is truly just on a mission to get this done this year. But everything you guys said is true. Golden State has a lot more room to improve. They can make plenty more adjustments. They can certainly shoot the ball a lot better, whereas Cleveland, I think this is peak Cavaliers. I don't think they can play any better.
Yeah. I'll add this, though. I said this the other day. We've said this a bunch of times. I always thought that the Cavaliers were going to be good this year and better next year. I mean, when you think about that they can add this kind of grinding style and win some games this way, and then next year they're going to add, you know, and by add, I mean just keep. You know, they get Kyrie Irving back. I don't think Kevin Love's going anywhere. Kevin Love comes back. They make a couple of tweaks in the rush. That's a team that's going to be able to beat you a lot of different ways next season, and this is one of them now. I mean, this is part of who they are.
Well, not to get on too much of a tangent with the next season roster thing, but you know, it's worth wondering whether Kevin Love is a max player for Cleveland, the way that they played without him with Tristan Thompson in the starting lineup. You know, it's an interesting decision for the front office to make, you know, going into this summer and into the future, but you know, we'll have all summer to talk about the Cavaliers roster for next season. We'll keep it focused on the finals here. Good stuff as always, guys, and we will be back following Game 3 to break it all down once again.